It was a long, hard-working summer and fall, Dollier wrote. By July 1, 6 weeks after the St. Louis caucus, we had less than 1,000 post going. But by August 1, the number had more than doubled, and by September 1, it had quadrupled. On October 1, the number of posts was 5,670, and we felt that the Legion was right and would win. At the first national convention in November that year, Dollier found himself on the ballot for national commander, a position he had not asked for, dreamed of, or even particularly relished. I left for Minneapolis a candidate for nothing except some railroad tickets to my family on that promised vacation, he wrote. Bill Donovan and Ted Roosevelt talked me into permitting my name to go before the convention. They picked me for my negative qualities. I had never made a public speech in my life. I had never given an interview to a newspaper reporter. I had never been in politics and would never get in because I lacked the qualifications. I was thought to be capable of giving the Legion a quiet, plain business administration, which was felt to be a good thing during a presidential year. Dollier, beholden to no one and without any obvious political persuasions or desires, was just what the Legion needed to avoid the politicization that had divided previous veterans' organizations. I was no orator, had no desire to become one, and anyway felt that the country was a bit fed up on oratory and that the public would be more interested in plain business statements as to what the Legion was actually accomplishing and intended to do. I felt that the public would be more interested in brief communiques from the front than an oratorical effort. Campbell wrote that the organizational model for the Legion was the MTCA, which had sought mass-based participation. The Legion was not meant to be a tightly controlled elite organization like the NSL. Ideologically, the Legion's leaders believed in what they were doing and that the vast majority of common Americans shared their views. Unsurprisingly, many of the first resolutions passed by the Legion dealt with preparedness. The report of the Committee on Military Policy set forth unambiguously its belief that a large standing army is uneconomic and un-American. National safety with freedom from militarism is best assured by a national citizen army and navy based on the democratic and American principles of the quality of obligation and opportunity for all. Universal military training and, importantly, not universal military service would long be a priority of the Legion. We have had a bitter experience in the cost of unpreparedness for national defense and the lack of proper training on the part of officers and men, the committee reported. We favor a national military and naval system based on universal military obligation to include a relatively small regular army and navy and a citizen army and navy capable of rapid expansion sufficient to meet any national emergency. The Plattsburgh idea had become official policy of the brand new American Legion. The committee added in its first report that we favor the continuance of training camps for the training and education of officers to serve in case of national requirement. Physical and mental discipline, military preparedness, promotion of democracy, and strengthening of young people all were undoubtedly topics discussed among future founders of the American Legion between training camp exercises before the war. And when they had proof of their convictions fresh in mind in the winter of 1919, they turned their principles into an organization that would long outlive them. Mark Seavey is a writer and digital media specialist for the American Legion. Sidebar: Revolutionary Legions. December 18, 1778. In the first known use of the name, the American Legion of Honor is formed in Massachusetts. The fraternal group lasts about 20 years. After fleeing to New York, where the British Army gave him a commission as a brigadier general, infamous Revolutionary War traitor Benedict Arnold led what was called an American Legion of more than 1,000 Crown Loyalists, who were mainly deserters from the U.S. Continental Army. End of sidebar. Sidebar. Debility of nerves. 10 years after his service in the Revolutionary War ended, Jeremiah Ryan was granted a federal pension of $5 per month in what is considered the earliest disability compensation for what would later be known as post-traumatic stress disorder. Secretary of War Henry Knox, who decided such cases individually at the time, wrote in his decision that Ryan suffered a debility of nerves, which has continued ever since in such a degree as utterly to incapacitate him from obtaining a livelihood. 190 years later, the federal government began recognizing PTSD. End of sidebar. Sidebar. The first VSO. Regarded as America's first veterans service organization, the Society of the Cincinnati was founded on May 13, 1783, by Major General Henry Knox. The organization restricted membership to former officers of the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. General Washington was the first president general of the Society, followed by Alexander Hamilton. The Society still operates today as a hereditary organization headquartered in Washington, D.C. End of sidebar. Sidebar. American Legion Incorporated. In 10 years or less time, the U.S. is going to find herself in a man-sized fight. I vote that all of us drifting around, and who would ordinarily volunteer to fight for our country, begin to form some sort of volunteer organization now through adventure. Then, if something turns up, we can all get together and volunteer in a body. Personally, when I get into a scrap, I like to know that fellows with me are not going to go up in the air when they get in a tight place. Ed D. Cook, in a 1914 letter to Adventure magazine, from Puerto Limon, Costa Rica, published in the November issue of the popular magazine that year. 4 years before the Paris caucus that launched the American Legion, a different corporation of the same name and similar ideals was formed in the New York City office of Adventure magazine. American Legion Incorporated was a nationwide registry of volunteers with specialized skills, vehicles, weapons, and military training or experience. The roster soared to more than 25,000, and on January 1, 1917, American Legion Incorporated turned the names over to the U.S. War Department so willing volunteers could be summoned when the United States declared entry in World War I. The concept originated from a 1914 letter to Adventure that called for veterans, whose training and service records were largely unkept at the time, to go in together, knowing that everyone in the outfit can obey orders and handle a gun. Announcements appeared in magazines across the country in March 1915. The Legion believes in making instantly available to our country, in case of war, all men who already have military or technical training valuable in modern warfare by land or sea, to be used as the government, not they themselves, may see fit, according to their qualifications. Dues were 25 cents a year. For another 25 cents, a member could also get a button. The announcement listed 77 classifications to include such specialties as driver, powder man, experience with explosives, surgeon, miner, motorboat operator, balloonist, blacksmith, cowboy, and concrete worker. At the time, the U.S. Armed Forces consisted of less than 300,000. Some 3.7 million more would ultimately be needed for the war. American Legion Incorporated received endorsement from former President Theodore Roosevelt and acceptance from Major General Leonard Wood, former U.S. Army Chief of Staff and leader of the Plattsburgh, New York training camps. Among the early members of American Legion Incorporated was also Theodore Roosevelt Jr., the former president's son. The offices at 10 Bridge Street were at once swamped, not only with applications, applicants, and reporters, but with people of all kinds who offered their services free to help handle the work. Adventure editor Arthur Sullivan Hoffman wrote in the July 1934 American Legion Monthly, "The pacifists went wild in the other direction." The War Department recruited specialists and officers from American Legion Incorporated, including two aircraft maintenance regiments. Following the Paris Caucus, when the American Legion was approved as a temporary name for the new organization, Hoffman gladly agreed to transfer the title of the defunct organization to the one that just sprang to life. According to that earlier American Legion, in the 1934 American Legion Monthly. Jeff Stoffer. End of sidebar. Sidebar. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. Theodore Roosevelt Jr., the Plattsburgh-trained son of a U.S. president, was commissioned as a major in 1917. On June 20th of that year, he and brother Archie sailed to France after a letter of endorsement from their father, allowing them to fight in the first wave under General John Pershing's American Expeditionary Forces. Roosevelt Jr. fought through enemy fire and poison gas, leading from the front. He received high praise, was promoted, and commanded the 26th Regiment of the 1st Division. Gassed nearly to blindness, he refused evacuation and received the Silver Star for his actions at Cantigny. Later, near Soissons, Roosevelt Jr. was shot in the left leg. While recuperating at a field hospital, he reportedly met a Sergeant William Patterson, later killed in action, who inspired Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt Jr. to help launch the American Legion. At 56, Brigadier General Roosevelt Jr. came ashore at Utah Beach in the first wave of the World War II D-Day invasion of June 6, 1944. Armed with nothing more than a pistol and his cane, he helped soldiers cross the beach to safety, eluding enemy fire. For his actions that day, Roosevelt Jr. received the Medal of Honor. However, it would be awarded posthumously. He died of a heart attack on July 12, 1944, and was buried in Normandy, where he remains today, next to his youngest brother, Quentin, who had been shot down and killed over Ain, France, 26 years earlier, during World War I. End of sidebar. Sidebar. Struggle for benefits. Veterans of the Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Mexican War fought for government pensions, but the battle was always tough. Most who received compensation from Revolutionary War service, including combat-wounded Daniel Shays, who led a violent rebellion in Massachusetts over unfair debt collections imposed on former soldiers, had to wait 25 or more years for any relief. Shays was pardoned in 1788 for leading the rebellion, and in 1818 finally received a pension, with which he bought a small cabin. End of sidebar. Sidebar. Civil War veterans, the Grand Army of the Republic, and the United Confederate Veterans emerged after the Civil War. Aspects of each veterans group, like the GAR's organizational model and the massive convention parades of the UCV, would later serve as examples for the American Legion. Former GAR and UCV halls, event traditions, records of the war dead, and memorabilia were turned over to Legion posts in many communities. The Civil War associations were designed to disappear when the last of their war's veterans died in the mid-1950s. End of sidebar. Sidebar: Franklin Dollye, the son of a Philadelphia cotton merchant and eventual president of Prudential Insurance, Princeton-educated Franklin Dollye was a calm, unflappable problem solver who commanded the Army's first salvage depot in France for the Quartermaster Corps during World War I. He was promoted to lieutenant colonel as his personnel and responsibilities grew, and was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for his organizational skills. He was also one of the 20 officers of the American Expeditionary Forces who came to a February 1919 dinner in Paris with Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Roosevelt, Jr., to lay the groundwork for the American Legion. After his April 1919 discharge, Dollye worked in New York City to help get the Legion started, committing both his time and money. In November, at 42, he was elected to serve as the Legion's first national commander. He declined a salary and covered his own expenses in a year of crisscrossing the nation to drive membership. His acceptance speech at the first national convention had four sentences. "My word is simply this: we came here to work. Let us keep on working and not listen to speeches. I thank you." Dollye's skills were later summoned when he helped lead the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey that assessed the effectiveness of Allied bombing missions in both theaters of World War II, work that influenced the establishment of the Air Force. End of sidebar. Captions: 1. Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Roosevelt and his Rough Riders stand victorious atop San Juan Hill. 2. Businessmen arrive at the Plattsburgh camp to spend their summer holiday preparing to become military leaders. End of captions.